from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Saddam is gone. American troops rule Iraq north, south, east, and west, and still the weapons of mass destruction have not been found. A biological, chemical, even nuclear weapons threat was the Bush administration's number one and urgent justification for war. The U.S. got that war, but not the WMD. Tonight on Point, credibility, foreign policy, and democracy. We begin with the uproar in Britain over the missing weapons of mass destruction. America's staunchest ally, Prime Minister Tony Blair, now faces a parliamentary investigation over how intelligence information was used to make the case for war. Jonathan Marcus is military defense correspondent for the BBC. I asked him how serious the credibility problem has become for Prime Minister Blair.
Well, I think it's very serious in terms of long-term credibility. I think it is serious for a number of other security reasons more than anything else. What is clear, though, is it certainly doesn't represent a significant threat to his administration. There is no alternative prime minister waiting in the wings, and the opposition, as you well know in this country at the moment, is still very, very weak. I think it is worrying, though, because, of course, it goes to the heart of the legality of the claims for a war against Iraq. It raises serious questions about the veracity of the prime minister and the government. Did they manipulate information or not? It also raises, obviously, also some very worrying concerns about the way intelligence is used, about the quality of that intelligence, which I think is worrying on both sides of the Atlantic. Certainly, if one agrees with President Bush that there is a major war underway against some sort of terrorist threat, then clearly intelligence and accurate intelligence is very much the front line of that struggle.
Even more than President Bush, Tony Blair made the case for war very narrowly on the threat of weapons of mass destruction. Just how narrowly did Blair make that case?
Well, you say rightly, very narrowly indeed. Remember, of course, the fundamental difference between Britain and the United States in terms of legitimizing this conflict was, I think, quite clearly that September 11th happened in the United States. It did not happen in Britain. I think that gave the debate in the United States a completely different tone. Whether or not there were links between Iraq and the al-Qaeda organization. So Mr. Blair, in searching for legitimacy and a reason that would try and convince, one has to say, a fairly skeptical public in Britain, and even more skeptical amongst the chattering classes, if you like, the liberal intelligentsia, the liberal press, and so on, he phoned it down to this question of weapons of mass destruction. Not just weapons of mass destruction, but their imminent threat. A threat, it was alleged, that was so imminent that in certain cases it was said that the Iraqis could have recourse to these weapons within 45 minutes. And this really does seem to be a phrase that has returned to haunt the Prime Minister, because quite clearly when British forces went into Iraq, when American forces went into Iraq, they don't really seem to have found anything. Whatever one says they may or may not have found, they haven't found anything that seems to suggest an imminent threat of weapons of mass destruction of that kind.
And now we see front page headlines in the UK questioning whether Blair was a liar or a victim of lies. He's been given a very rough time in Parliament. Jonathan Marcus, let's listen to Tony Blair justifying his case in the British Parliament.
There have been many claims made about the Iraq conflict, that hundreds of thousands of people were going to die in it, that it was going to be my Vietnam, that the Middle East was going to be in flames, and this latest one, that weapons of mass destruction were a complete invention by the British government. The truth is, some people resent the fact it was right to go to conflict. We won the conflict thanks to the magnificent contribution of the British troops, and Iraq is now free, and we should be proud of that.
Jonathan Marcus, we have nothing like that kind of shouting and carrying on in the American Congress. But you say, despite that, despite the rough ride he's getting, he's secure in his seat. Has the American government been helpful to him? Donald Rumsfeld said recently that perhaps the weapons had been destroyed before the war. Did that shake Tony Blair at all?
Mr. Rumsfeld's comments have frankly not been very helpful to the Prime Minister here. Look, I think one has to really differentiate between two sets of things. One is the heat and light, if you like, of this debate about the motivation for the war, the imminence of the Iraqi threat, and so on. One has to say that there is an awful lot of political motivation in that debate. There are a lot of people here who did not like the idea of the war and who now feel that they can get their own come back about the Prime Minister. I think one has to say that the debate about whether or not Iraq in some form or another had or has a weapons program is really a very different issue. On that, we just do not know yet. The jury is still out. I think it is quite clear that if you ask the question, for example, did Iraq prior to the war have the know-how or the scientific capacity to have a weapons program, the answer is clearly yes. If you ask the question, did Iraq have the equipment in some cases, often dual-use equipment, to make pathogens, to breed pathogens, to make chemical weapons, the answer again is probably yes. Did the regime in Iraq still put these weapons of mass destruction into a central place in its strategic worldview for the future? Well, there was nothing about Saddam Hussein's behavior that would lead one to believe that he had changed his view about these weapons. So I think there is a lot still to be found out about that program. There are a lot of people to be interviewed. There's a lot of paperwork. Who knows? Maybe even some tangible things may turn up. Of course, that is different. That is a generalized debate about Iraq's capability, about the motivation of the Iraqi regime in the longer term. What the government here and what the government in the United States pressed was an imminent threat, a threat that required war now, not the threat of war later. It required immediate military action straight away. And, of course, that is, with this emblem of the 45-minute warning, as it were, that is the problem that is being faced by Mr. Blair in Britain.
Does the fact that weapons of mass destruction have then not shown up as yet promise to make it more difficult for London to quickly ally with Washington in future efforts in other countries in the war on terrorism the next time intelligence shows up something alleged to be menacing?
I think it is going to cause problems. I frankly think it's going to cause problems on both sides of the Atlantic. Obviously, there are full-scale congressional investigations underway in the States. There are reviews by the CIA of the evidence. There are going to be similar reviews in this country as well. I think this, in many ways, is the most worrying dimension of this whole affair. We have very similar problems, proliferation, regarding Iran. Very similar problems regarding North Korea. North Korea, remember, a country with which the United States almost went to war in 1994, we are told by William Perry, a former U.S. Defense Secretary. So in those debates, the intelligence assessments, what the British and the American governments, so your government obviously in particular, are saying about these countries' arsenals are going to be absolutely crucial in framing the public debate and in framing the policy options that are taken. And I think if populations on both sides of the Atlantic cannot be convinced about the truthfulness or the accuracy of what is being told to them, that is clearly going to affect their attitude to the Bush administration, to their attitude towards supporting the Bush administration in whatever adventures may lie in the future. And that is, I think, a very serious problem.
Jonathan Marcus, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Marcus is military defense correspondent for the BBC. He spoke with us from London. For months, the Bush administration built its case for war with Iraq on the loud allegation of an imminent threat from Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. Now, the war is won, but the weapons have not yet been found. Bush administration officials still say they will be uncovered. But shamed and angry intelligence voices now say their reports were twisted and abused to make the case for war. And the larger questions that loom go to American credibility globally and to the right of people at home to know the facts before going to war. Do you believe that WMD will still be found in Iraq? Is liberation enough? Or does Washington now have a credibility problem? What are the consequences when a superpower is not believed? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from beautiful Duck, North Carolina, is Larry Johnson. He was a CIA officer from 1985 to 1989 and deputy director of the U.S. State Department Office of Counterterrorism from 1989 to 1993. Good evening and welcome, Larry Johnson.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Hi there.
Larry Johnson, take us, if you would, into intelligence circles. I'm sure you're very much still in touch with the people who gather intelligence and interpret it for the United States. What's the buzz? It sounds angry from the outside. What's the word coming out of intelligence circles about how intelligence on weapons of mass destruction alleged in Iraq was used?
The level of anger is probably as great as at any time in the history of the Central Intelligence Agency. About 5 weeks ago, I sent an email to one of my friends who's still in the agency and occupies a very senior position. And in an attempt to be diplomatic, I had suggested that perhaps there had been the Bush administration had found itself misled. And he wrote back and said, have you discounted the possibility that it was there was fabrication? And what this person shared with me and has been reiterated by some other folks who are still in the community, as it were, is that there has not been this level of disgust, anger, disappointment in their memory.
Larry Johnson, why such high disgust? I mean, this is not the first time that intelligence has been used in a political way. If indeed
right.
That's what's going on here. So what's the difference this time?
Well, it is just that point. Several of us have been through this effort to politicize intelligence in the past, and some of the folks I'm talking to have been right in the middle of those battles. And they're saying what they're seeing this time was so egregious and exaggerated that it requires a reaction. Because at the end of the day, when you allow this to happen, it ends up jeopardizing the credibility of the president. I went through the loss of credibility that the President Reagan suffered in the wake of the Iran-Contra scandal. Mm-hmm. I was working the Honduran account in the Central Intelligence Agency at the time. I was copying documents for the investigating committees of Congress. And I had a front-row seat in efforts that had been taken to influence the intelligence process back then. When you destroy a president's credibility, that's not something that's easily regained.
But, Larry, are we at that point yet? I mean, lots of new troops are being put into looking for these weapons of mass destruction. They may still be found as we hang here out over the cliff, not found, not entirely unfound. Could it still be that the intelligence as presented to the American public and the world will be redeemed?
No. And let's start with even the term weapon of mass destruction. A nuclear weapon is a weapon of mass destruction. A chemical and biological agent are weapons that can potentially cause mass casualties. Yet as looking at it just empirically, where we have seen them used, in the Iran-Iraq war, when Iraq used the chemical and biological weapons against Iranian troops, out of 600,000 Iranian troops that died in that conflict, fewer than 10,000 died from chemical and biological agents.
So you're disputing the very language of the presentation itself. Jack Beatty, come in here with us. Larry Johnson, CIA man, has been with the U.S. State Department Counterterrorism Office, says President Bush's position here is irredeemable.
Well, he's certainly been put out on a limb. The question is, did he put himself out there or was he put there?
Right.
We just don't know that, do we? We don't know, at what point and by whom this evidence, such as it was massaged. It seems to me as if there was a very high level of pressure on CIA people. I mean, we read today that the vice president himself several times went to Langley and participated in meetings with people about this intelligence. And the implication of the article seemed to be that this was putting pressure on the analysts to come up with the details that they wanted. Now we read in the Wall Street Journal that while one department was saying one thing, say about the aluminum tubes, the Atomic Energy Commission was saying, "Oh no, that's dual use, that we don't have to worry about that at all." So it's a very shaky picture. And what may be the most disturbing thing about it is that 40% of the American people think we have already found the weapons of mass destruction, that this isn't even a question to them. Now, what does that say?
Well, I don't know what it says. I mean, President Bush talks about the two trailers that were picked up that could have been mobile labs, very much along the lines of the drawing that Colin Powell showed at the UN Security Council.
Well, I suppose, but that's a long way from the kinds of claims they were making. They weren't saying that they have a couple of trailers that might be used. They were talking about drones. They were talking about, reconstituted its nuclear program.
And the elements of wholesale mass destruction. Jack, Larry Johnson, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the missing weapons of mass destruction and the credibility of the Bush administration and the United States of America. Were weapons of mass destruction at the base of your understanding of why America went to war? Do you think they'll still be found? Or was the given cause for war an exaggeration, a lie? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the alleged deception of the Bush administration over intelligence information about the threat of weapons of mass destruction in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Many in the intelligence community have been up in arms in recent days about the politicization of intelligence reports. Gary Thielman is a former U.S. intelligence official who, until last September, was a top official in the State Department's Intelligence Bureau. In a BBC interview aired today, he expressed dismay at how intelligence information was used and abused in the run-up to war in Iraq.
What distressed me a lot in watching this close up was to see, even in the way that some of the other parts of the intelligence community, like the CIA, packaged information and presented it to its superiors, did not seem to always be the most objective. And then things just got worse the higher it got in the process, because clearly this administration was interested in getting arguments for a particular policy that it preferred.
That was Greg Thielman, a former U.S. intelligence official, in an interview with the BBC earlier today. We're talking tonight with Larry Johnson, former CIA officer and deputy director of the U.S. State Department Office of Counterterrorism, and with our own Jack Beatty joining us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire. You can join us as well. Does Washington have a credibility problem here, and what are the consequences when a superpower is not believed? Was there a giant bait and switch here, or are you still waiting in confidence that the weapons of mass destruction will be found? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Larry Johnson, a question for you. There are a lot of verbs being thrown around in relation to the intelligence and how it was used. We hear that the intelligence was massaged. We hear the word distorted. We hear the word lie. How do you describe what happened here? What's the process?
I think it's a combination of things. I think on the one hand, what I'm told is that elements linked to the Iraqi National Congress and Ahmad Chalabi were brought in so-called defectors whose information was allowed into the intelligence process. In other words, when someone's debriefed and that debriefing is written up, it's written up as a disseminable intelligence report.
Mm-hmm.
And once that's into the process, it then, because it's on paper, it's in black and white, it becomes fact, or at least a fact in dispute. So the fact that that kind of information was being put in. The other thing I'm told that took place was normally, you know, sometimes intelligence is murky, and it's not black and white. There are gray areas, and there are dissents or differences of opinion, and that's okay. The way you normally handle that is when there are differences of opinion, you write up the dissents, and the president's told, you know, Group A believes this. Group B believes this, and you lay out the arguments on both sides, so at least the president is offered the opportunity to know that there is a dispute and that there may be two or more sides to the issue. What I have been told is took place is that, in fact, those dissents were quashed, that the pressure that was applied was such that the analysts at CIA were basically told, you know, stop making these arguments because you're rocking the boat, and the position being pushed by people in the Department of Defense, Office of Special Plans, you know, directly linked to folks like Douglas Feith, Abram Shulsky, Steve Cambone. That group was pushing. They already had a predetermined outcome, and that view was the one that was writing the day.
The Office of Special Plans and the Pentagon you're referring to there with Douglas Feith. Larry Johnson, Jack Beatty, please stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation Richard Betts. He's a professor of war and peace studies and director of the Program in International Security Policy at Columbia University. He's an adjunct senior fellow in the National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good evening and welcome, Richard Betts.
Hello.
Thanks very much for joining us. Richard Betts, you're watching this debate, as we all are, about the quality of intelligence that was used to make the case, whether intelligence was distorted, whether there was lying going on in making the case for war in Iraq. President Bush stood in Iraq today and said, essentially, the truth will ultimately out here and we'll tell it like it is. What do you make of this? First of all, the whole contretemps over how intelligence was used and perhaps abused, is this a fair and constructive criticism for democracy to go through, or is this easy post-game backseat driving by people who didn't have to make the decisions?
Well, we'll know a lot more about the details about what really happened when two investigations are done. The internal one under the Director of Central Intelligence, and also Congress is going to get into the act in a big way. So more will come out about exactly who pressured whom and what sort of politicization there was or wasn't. But what we see now, and not surprisingly, is this whole question is getting caught up in politics from both ends, because this controversy is going to play into more general controversies about the aftermath of the war and the occupation in Iraq and what we should do about North Korea, Iran, or other rogue states.
Bob Graham, Democratic presidential candidate, said yesterday that President Bush should be held accountable if the intelligence was exaggerated. Is that the kind of politicization you're talking about?
Well, the president's always accountable in principle. In reality, the person who would probably get the most heat or take the fall for whatever happened would be the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, or whichever people in the Pentagon might be tagged with having corrupted the process if some of the current accusations turn out to be valid.
But Richard Betts, you're kind of there skirting in a way what feels like the central issue, and maybe it's simply too early to decide. But as someone who follows foreign policy and policy decision-making and policy communication to publics, including the American public, what do you make of the process that preceded the war with Iraq? Was it by the book, if there is a by the book? Was it as it should be? Was it open? Was it honest enough?
We don't know enough of the answers yet to be sure, but from what we know so far, it looks like the intelligence professionals reported accurately in a balanced way and revealed the ambiguities about what the evidence was. But at the policy level, it was used selectively and trumpeted to the public in a way that didn't really convey the thinness or the ambiguity of the information. You have to look at this at several levels. The intelligence level and the policy level. And it's typical that when the two interact, there can be a lot of ways in which information is misused or selectively represented. The political implications, I think, are going to depend a lot on what happens in other things. A, whether they do or don't find any appreciable stocks of weapons mass destruction, and B, whether the occupation and rebuilding of Iraq seems to fall into place or turns into a messy quagmire.
So if the occupation goes well, the economy turns up, happy days are here again, never mind, it'll be fine.
I think this will be an inside-the-beltway controversy if that happens. But if the occupation goes bad, it will compound the concerns about the justification of the war in the first place.
Jack Beatty, I want to turn to you, if I may. We've been following this issue for a long time here because so much hinged on, in the argument for, hinged on the existence and the imminent threat of weapons of mass destruction. And yet, as we hear Larry Johnson's conveying anger of the intelligence community tonight, we know that this is hardly the first time that that cases that were not exactly plumb were made for war in American history. Is this different?
Well, you know, a colleague raised that question with us the other day, and you know, you can look at three cases, and it's interesting to compare them: the Mexican War, the sinking of the Maine, and the Tonkin Gulf resolution. Now, in the Mexican War, what happened there was that we sent an army south of the Nueces River toward the Rio Grande. And once we crossed the Nueces, we were in territory claimed by Mexico. And some of our forces were ambushed. 18 dragoons were killed, 60-odd taken prisoner. And President Polk in Washington said, "American blood has been shed on American soil." And on the strength of that, he got a declaration of war.
So the border was moved a little bit there.
I'm sorry?
The border was moved a little bit there to make the claim.
And in fact, Abraham Lincoln, who was then a young Whig congressman, said, "Show me the spot, Mr. President." Was that spot on American soil? Was there ever a letter postmarked there? Did anyone ever pay taxes there who was an American?
Go Abe.
And for that, he was called Spotty Lincoln. But the real motive of the war, if you will, the oil of the war, was California. A year before the war began, Polk told his naval commander, "Look, if something happens in Texas, I want you to seize California." He denied that. He lied about that to the Congress. And when it was found out that he had actually seated the crew with people who could only be demobilized in California, he lied again. But what's different about it? 18 men were killed, whether on American soil or not. The Maine, well, you know, with the Maine, this battleship was sunk, and 300 men or so with officers went to the bottom of Havana Harbor. The Navy claimed that they were sunk by a mine. The Spanish, who were, you know, over the colonized Cuba and were fighting a war of repression against the Cuban rebels, the Spanish said, "Let us investigate. We think it was an internal cause." Well, it was an internal clause, according to Hyman Rickover in 1976, but our Navy said, "We can't look into that," and our yellow press ran with it, and we went to war. But the Maine did sink. Tonkin Gulf, 1964, August 1, 1964. The Maddox, an American destroyer, was fired on by North Vietnamese patrol boats. It returned the fire. The next, August 4th, the Turner Joy came, and it said it was fired on. We don't know. What was the deception when Johnson then went to Congress and said, active aggression, we're on the international waters? Where was the deception? The deception was that the North Vietnamese were responding to a CIA raid on their bases. So they were, you could say, acting in self-defense. But the fact is, torpedoes had been fired at American ships, and of course no damage had been done. What's different here is there's no cause of war.
Well, Jackie, but you know, when a microphone is put in front of American soldiers in Iraq, they cite 9/11 and they cite it without hesitation. I wonder, are you slicing the cheese too thin here? The Twin Towers came down, the Pentagon was hit. There hasn't been a case made that it was Iraq. Tom Friedman writes, though, the New York Times, that the real reason for this war, which was never stated, he says, was that after 9/11, America, in his words, needed to hit someone in the Arab Muslim world. Is that strategically credible, Jack, or is that just not on?
Well, you know, suppose the president then had gone to Congress and said, we need to hit somebody in the Muslim world. By the way, this somebody had nothing to do with September 11th, but we needed to sort of, you know, prick this boil of fractiousness in the Muslim world. So why don't we make war on Iraq? No one would have gone for that. I mean, you know, you've got to have a reason. The only reason that justifies killing 5,000 Iraqi civilians is self-defense. And the only justification for that is the weapons of mass destruction.
Jack, Larry Johnson, Richard Betts, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Andrew's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think the president deserves the benefit of the doubt because ultimately the person in control of the weapons until we arrived was Saddam Hussein himself, and we were
Of what weapons, Andrew?
Weapons of mass destruction.
But which ones are you referring to? They haven't been found.
Well, we did find a lot of munitions for carrying them, even before the war started. Empty shells, empty rockets. Now, I think it's possible that Saddam had two sets of orders to the guys who were holding on to the agents. Said, if you can get them to the front, get them to the front where they can be loaded and fired. If you can't get them to the front, take them as far away from it as you can and dump them.
So you're still willing to give the benefit of the doubt here. You're waiting to see, or do you care whether or not they're ultimately found, Andrew?
I think we had enough evidence that they were there and that they were prepared to be used. Like I said, the UN weapons inspectors found those 120-millimeter rockets that were supposed to be used for firing these weapons.
Andrew, we've got it. Let me put it to Larry Johnson. Larry, so much information was put out in advance of the war that many Americans, including Andrew, have the sense that there was A, B, and C pieces of the WMD threat. They were right there for us to see. Were these credible pieces?
No, they weren't credible. And let me put myself, I'm in a position I think we should have taken down Saddam. I'm not one of these that was against going to war, but I'm very much against going to war for the wrong reasons and misrepresenting the threat to the American people. And again, it goes back to this issue of the misuse of even the language. When Saddam Hussein used biological weapons, he used them with massive artillery support and the support of aerial platforms. This is not the kind of thing that he could just pass to a terrorist group and then that they could run over here and use quickly against Americans and, quote, cause mass casualties. That was not only an exaggeration, it was misleading, and it was playing on the fears of Americans. But beyond that, what we saw, in my judgment, was a covert action program along the lines of one that we used to run against the Soviets when they were in Afghanistan. And what I mean by a covert action program is a steady drip of information that has a kernel of truth, but in some respects is misleading. What we've seen is, for example, the president saying Iraq was trying to procure radioactive material from Niger. We know now that was a complete fabrication. The Brits presented this white paper that I was told 3 months ago by friends in the intelligence community in Europe that MI5 and MI6 put that together under protest, and when they put it together, they then leaked the facts to the media that they had put it together under protest.
This is the one that said Saddam could deliver death and destruction in 45 minutes.
I don't know if it said no. This one is the one that they plagiarized basically from this Monterey scholar.
Right.
And then since then, we've seen this continued drumbeat. For example, the weapons are hidden in Syria. Or then the latest iteration that came out 3 weeks ago, I think it was on the O'Reilly factor with General Paul Vallalet saying, oh, no, they were taken through Syria. They're now buried in the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. We need to go in and get those. Or France supplied passports to the Iraqis. These are leaks that are coming. This is information that's being disseminated by people in the Department of Defense that I am told are with the Office of Special Plans. And that information is out there to do one thing, to drive the public. Look this week on the front page of the Washington Times, which leaks that Al-Qaeda is preparing to attack and to use chemical and biological weapons.
And the drip goes on, and we don't want to get too far off of plumb here. David's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just think that that the Bush administration foisted a big lie on the American public and manipulated their fears after 9/11, and it was the responsibility of the media to actually investigate their claims and compare it to the evidence. And if you will looked at even the UN reports from the 1991 to 1997 inspections, that you would have they reported that 95% of the weapons were actually destroyed. And I'm just interested in why now that the media is finally focusing on the possibility that the Bush administration manipulated the intelligence they did receive in order to garner public support for a war that had really nothing to do about weapons of mass destruction.
David, we've got it. Thanks for your call. I have to say there were no small number of forums, this one included, where these questions were raised. On the other hand, tracking this all down and confirming it in that kind of rush to war when the drumbeat is coming out of Colin Powell in the White House and the Pentagon is not easy. But Richard Betts, how about it? Was this a falling down of the American media in double-checking somehow the information that was being put on the table or the alleged information?
The media can't check secret information. The problem is the circumstantial evidence looked pretty overwhelming, and it's a great mystery why the pieces that seem to be there don't add up to anything in the aftermath so far. But I think the real significance of this at this point, half of it, is in the effect it'll have on other policies. The great irony is now this controversy is probably going to make it all the much harder for the administration to act against more serious and more definite threats like North Korea.
So this goes to the real credibility issue, and you see that as having a lasting effect.
Well, I think it's taken the momentum out of the hawks who wanted to take on the next countries on the list, as it were. So unless WMD are found in Iraq and everything looks good in the occupation, the barriers to doing anything to Syria or North Korea now are going to be much higher than they would have been otherwise.
One way or another may actually come back to bite American security itself. We're talking tonight about the missing weapons of mass destruction and the credibility of the Bush administration and the United States of America. Yes, a bad regime was removed, but in a democracy, shouldn't the people know why they're going to war? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the missing weapons of mass destruction still missing in Iraq and the credibility of the Bush administration, the credibility of the United States of America. My guests tonight are Larry Johnson, a former CIA officer and deputy director of the U.S. State Department Office of Counterterrorism until 1993, and Richard Betts, professor of war and peace studies and director of the program in international security policy at Columbia University. Richard Betts, a couple of things I want to put to you. Tom Friedman writes that the Bush team never dared to spell out the real reason for the war, which was the need, as he sees it, to hit somebody, the felt need to hit someone in the Middle East in response to 9/11. And it felt that it could not win public or world support for what he calls the right reasons and the moral reasons, the right reasons that the United States needs to begin to build democratic nations in the Middle East, the moral reason that the U.S. could see a moral obligation to liberate the Iraqis. Does it matter in foreign policy terms if the president spells out the honest reasons for war or not? Jack Beatty's laid out a historical record here, but when you look at it, if the president feels that there's a need for war but doesn't feel that the real reasons in his mind or his advisors' minds can persuade the American public, is he justified in going to war on a red herring?
Well, it's not a question of which was the real reason. There were a lot of reasons, and WMD were one of them. But when it comes to politics, obviously the president and his chief lieutenants are going to make the most out of the reasons they think will sell, and they're going to make the least out of the ones they think will be most controversial. So Friedman's right in the sense that if they came out baldly and said, well, Iraq isn't responsible for 9/11, but at least we can get at Iraq when we can't get at Al-Qaeda, that would obviously not have been a strong selling point.
But is this acceptable in a democracy?
They didn't care about WMD.
But is that all right in a democracy to bend the message to make the war happen? Or is that just real politic, or is it a moral or political problem?
It's not good. It's not right. But it's the logic of democracy. When you're trying to persuade the public and get majority support, people on any side of any question are going to be politically successful, are going to emphasize what they think the public's going to buy.
But
it's not just on this issue.
Larry Johnson.
It's not just a matter of politics. It's a matter of international law. I mean, the only reason we have countries can invade other countries is self-defense.
Now, let me just jump in. There was one thing that Dr. Betz said earlier that I'd like to give an additional some explanation for.
Please.
That one thing that did not occur before this the war started that really puzzled me and one of my other friends, Patrick Lang, who was in charge of the Defense Intelligence Agency's analysis of the Middle East on the first Gulf War. In previous cases where we've had clear intelligence information of some egregious behavior on the part of either a terrorist group or a foreign country, the United States has put together briefing teams where you go around and tell foreign governments you really put all the family jewels on the table and show them exactly what's being done.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of the Tiny Star, which Libya funded and armed and trained a terrorist amphibious assault against Israel. Initially, countries like Italy, Spain, France discounted our explanation of what happened, but we went and showed them the intelligence, and it was so credible that they came around and said, okay, that's right.
So is that the counterpart of what Colin Powell did before the Security Council?
No, absolutely not. That, you know, that was a sanitized public version. What I'm talking about mm-hmm. is behind the closed doors, we basically take off all your clothes and say, here's exactly what's going on.
And this time?
Did not happen. And we were puzzled why that wasn't happening, because the fact of it was important to bring the Germans, the French, and others on board. And the reason why they didn't do it, it's clear now, they didn't have it. You cannot go brief something you don't have.
And so they used what they had with the public, but not in that kind of full and naked explanation of what's going on. Chuck Beatty, what's your reading here? Does this set the administration really in a class by itself, or is it just the very contemporary version of what presidents have done before, updated? Yes, different, you've pointed that out, but in line with stretching the truth to make a policy happen?
Well, I mean, it has precedent, but as I say, the difference here is there's no act of any kind, even construable act of belligerency. So, and under international law, there either has to be that act, or given our preemptive doctrine, that has to be an imminent possibility. I think that was probably one of the reasons Tony Blair used that statement about they could put stuff together in 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But as our CIA man is telling us, wait a minute, you just can't transfer these armaments to terrorists or I think at one point there was a talk about drones off the coast of America. That's not how it works at all.
Richard Betz, just a couple of seconds here, but final word, the American public treated right here or not?
No, of course not, but it's not the first time. The unfortunate thing is there seem to be a number of people in this administration who are more extreme than usual in taking thin gruel and running with it. And they've been, up until now, pretty successful with that tactic.
Well, they're off and running. Richard Betz, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Richard Betz is professor of war and peace studies and director of the program in international security policy at Columbia University. And Larry Johnson in beautiful Duck, North Carolina. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Larry Johnson is a former CIA officer and was deputy director of the U.S. State Department Office of Counterterrorism. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Less than 5 weeks after the Jason Blair scandal broke and a week after the resignation of Rick Bragg over questionable attribution, a stunning page turned today at the New York Times. This morning, Howell Raines resigned as executive editor of the Times and Gerald Boyd resigned from his post as the paper's managing editor. Raines and Boyd, both highly regarded, seasoned journalists, faced intense criticism after the Blair and Bragg debacles. With its two top editors out the door in an unprecedented house cleaning, the Times found itself unhappily making the news again. Seth Mnookin, media writer for Newsweek, has been following the story. I asked him what finally produced the top-level resignations at the Times.
Well, I think that when Jason Blair was caught plagiarizing and then it turned out he had also been fabricating at the New York Times, that was obviously a very grave crisis for that paper. But Jason Blair is not the reason that Howell Raines and Gerald Boyd were forced to resign. That debacle uncovered deeper fissures in the newsroom. There was a lot of built-up resentment about how the paper was being run under Howell and Gerald, and a couple of reporters at the Times used the analogy that there was all this kindling already built up in the newsroom, and Jason was just the spark that ignited it. Obviously, after that, you had Rick Bragg resign, and Rick Bragg is someone who wasn't doing a lot of breaking news stories. He was doing really color features, and what that got to was this sense of a very deep-rooted arrogance on the part of the Times, and in fact, that's not how most Times reporters do their jobs.
Seth Mnookin, what then is this deeper wellspring of resentment that you say boiled over to push Howell Raines and Gerald Boyd out today?
Well, one of the things that Howell spoke very often about was a desire to increase the metabolism of the paper, and a term that he coined, flood the zone, which means throw all of your resources at any given story. I personally think that was probably a good impulse, but he did that in a way that didn't take into consideration concerns or opinions of really anyone outside of a very closely held group of top editors. So people who were used to having a fair amount of input in what happened in the paper on a day-to-day basis were being frozen out. He also instituted somewhat of a star system where there were a chosen number of reporters who got page one treatment and got plum assignments, and a lot of other people obviously felt very resentful about that. And one of the criticisms that's been leveled against the paper is that, at least at the very top, there was insufficient skepticism about how a reporter like Jason, who is only 27 years old, was able to parachute into stories like the sniper story and beat everyone else within a day or two, including obviously reporters from the Washington Post and the Baltimore Sun who had been on the ground in those areas for years.
Now, it wasn't just Howell Raines with his difficult reputation for arrogance, but also Gerald Boyd, the highest-ranking African-American at the New York Times. Why Boyd as well?
You know, Gerald was the number two, the managing editor, the guy who ran the newsroom, and there was a sense that they were really operating as a team. And they just, over the past month, and especially over the last week or two, it seems that they just lost all of the faith and confidence of the newsroom. And there was not a sense at all that keeping Gerald on would have enabled the paper to turn a corner.
It was only a few weeks ago on Mother's Day that the publisher of the Times, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., assured the staff that Raines would not be going. Now he's gone. Do you know what the mechanism was, or who met with whom to say these guys have to go?
Well, that's the $10 million question, and right now it's all speculation as to what exactly happened. I think it's very possible that Howell himself realized that this was an untenable situation. I wrote a story yesterday in which the business editor of the Times, Glenn Cramon, told me very upfront, I'm not sure if Howell's going to make it, and we need to carry on and start concentrating on putting out a great paper again and not worry about who's going to be in the corner office. That's an incredible change from a staff that a month ago was, for the most part, not even comfortable questioning Howell's story judgment. We don't know yet if Arthur Sulzberger Jr., the publisher, went and told Howell, okay, the time has come. It's also possible that the New York Times board went to Arthur Sulzberger and said, look, we got to do something. This is beginning to affect our reputation, and our reputation is really what we're selling.
Any sense that Arthur Sulzberger Jr.'s job itself is on the line here?
Well, the New York Times is a publicly traded company, but it's also a family, essentially a family-owned and a family-run company. Arthur has been the publisher for a number of years and has had a pretty good track record in terms of trying to increase its revenue streams, and the paper's profitability, the whole company's profitability, has been pretty good under Arthur. So, again, this is all guesswork because the board has been very quiet and has not spoken out publicly, but I would assume that he is going to be okay and he'll remain as publisher and chairman. That being said, if you asked me 2 weeks ago, I probably would have said I assume that in another year, Hal Raines will still be editor. So we're clearly in an extraordinary time.
An extraordinary news today with the executive editor and managing editor of the New York Times stepping down. What's the mood in the New York Times newsroom today, Seth? You must have been on the phones there.
Yeah, I was. And for someone who, especially in the last month, really had become incredibly unpopular, I think there's a lot of sadness. There's a real realization that this is a tragedy, both a personal tragedy for Hal and Gerald, two men who, whatever their flaws, were great newsmen, incredibly ambitious, incredibly talented, and now this is a sad coda to their careers. There's also sadness just about what's happened to the paper. And underneath all that, I think there's a hope and an expectation that everyone is going to be able to turn the page and the New York Times will stop being the focus of the news and can get back to reporting the news.
Seth Mnookin, you follow this so closely. Step back for a second. What's the big lesson here? The big journalistic lesson, the big personal lesson?
Well, I've been perhaps naively really shocked by the low esteem that so much of the country seems to hold the journalistic community in. I've been on a lot of radio and TV call-in programs around the country, and again and again and again I hear people saying, we're not surprised by this. We have always believed that the media has made up quotes or invented stories. We don't trust what we read or see anyway, and I think that is the underlying issue that we, as journalists, the entire journalistic community, needs to figure out a way to address. But I think that's been the underlying story in this whole thing, and that's why this has moved on from being just a story about turmoil at one paper to a story about the culture of journalism in America today.
And finally, Seth, Joe Lilliefeld, Hal Raines' predecessor, has come back to serve apparently as an interim editor. What's the talk about who may be the permanent successor to Hal Raines? Are the names being floated?
Again, we get back to questions about the board. There are names being floated, but it's all guesswork at this point. You know, one of the names is Marty Baron, who is the editor right now of the Boston Globe. He's someone who comes from the New York Times culture, is running a paper now. Before he got to the Globe, was running the Miami Herald. And so he has a track record, a very strong track record of running very good newspapers. I talked with him on Tuesday, and he said he had not been approached about the job at all and that he was very happy where he was. Another name that's being discussed is Dean Baquet, who right now is the managing editor of the Los Angeles Times, was the national editor of the New York Times. Another name is Bill Keller, who had been Joe Lelyveld's managing editor and now is a op-ed columnist and a magazine writer for the Times. But I think if the past weeks have shown us anything, it's that we should all stand to be surprised by what happens next. And obviously there's a limited number of candidates who have the experience and knowledge of that culture and that company, but I think the Times is in a mode right now where they're breaking tradition and they're going to find the best candidate, and it might not even be someone any of us had thought of.
Seth Mnookin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Seth Mnookin covers media for Newsweek. He spoke with us from New York City. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris O'Connor, Darren Manoogian, and Dan Rose. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is